Before we begin, before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to draw your attention to these beautiful term cards once again. As I mentioned last week, I invested a lot of aesthetic attention into these and a lot of creativity. So I hope you enjoy them. I also went with an optimistic theme, as you'll see, with the sort of clouds on the horizon with sunshine. So a little something to warm our hearts this winter. But there's a list of the upcoming talks on the back. Remember, next week we're meeting on Tuesday, and we're meeting at the Town Hall, and Tim Keller will be speaking. It's an OIQ event. We'll be speaking there at 8 p.m., and there will be a champagne reception, and that's our joint event, but of course you're encouraged to go and welcome to go to hear Keller as well. And that's, Os Guinness will be present at the reception. And that will be immediately after the talk. The talk begins at 8, and remember that's Tuesday rather than our regular Monday. So, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Nigel Bigger. He is the Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at Christ Church and the director of the McDonald Center in Theology, Ethics, and Public Life. Yes, got it. And he has recently published a book, In Defense of War, and it's on just war theory, and he will be speaking on that tonight.
Great. Thank you very much. I probably don't need this, but I'm going to put it on anyway, just in case. Does that work? Good. I'm not struggling myself. All right, so I was asked to speak, I think, for 45 minutes or thereabouts. You've got a handout, which I confess wasn't designed especially for you. It relates to a talk I gave early last month, but I'm going to follow most of it. So that does give you a map of what I'm going to cover. I haven't timed this exactly, but it's 7:45 now, and I certainly won't speak beyond 7:30.
We're not worried about time.
Okay.
Whichever is shorter or...
It'll take as long as it takes. But I don't want to talk too long. It's better to have time to discuss. So as Carl said, I published a book just over a year ago called In Defense of War, which is, in fact, In Defense of Just War, and more specifically, In Defense of the Christian understanding of just war. I'm not going to give you a kind of general outline of the doctrine. I'm going to focus on something in particular, but before I do that, here's a brief introduction to just war thinking. In Christianity, it's normally thought to have found its first expression in the thought and writings of Augustine of Hippo. So we're talking early 5th century, early 400s. And ever since then, it has been developed, and it continues to have proponents around today, myself included. The notion of a just war is not confined to Christianity. Certainly, to my knowledge, you will find analogues of it in Islamic thinking. And as I discovered when I made my first visit to Hong Kong year before last, there are significant analogues with Confucian and Neo-Confucian thinking in China. The latter is very significant because, of course, Islam, to some extent, draws from both Judaism and Christianity, so you wouldn't be surprised to find some points of commonality there. Whereas Confucianism and Neo-Confucianism, sort of 6th century BC, 14th century AD, at that point Chinese civilization had no contact, significant contact at all, with the West, so entirely separate. and yet not the similar ways of thinking about these things. Now, just to make clear that in Christian thinking about justified war, the assumption is, of course, that the resolution of conflict by peaceful means is much preferable, right? So that's where you start. If you've got a conflict, then by all means, if it can be resolved peacefully, then resolve it peacefully. Because war, even when justified, causes very great evils. People get killed, people get bereaved, cities get destroyed, infrastructure gets destroyed. So it causes lots of damage. Nevertheless, in Christian just war thinking, causing the evils of war can be morally justified as a last resort. If no other means are available, if no other realistic means are available for resolving a conflict, violent means may be used as a last resort. So as a last resort, war is just when it intends to stop and correct a grave injustice. In the Christian view, there are some contemporary moral philosophical views which will tell you that the paradigm, the model of a just war is self-defense. You may have heard of the American political philosopher Michael Walzer. His classic book, Just and Unjust Wars, published in the 1970s, asserts that national self-defense is the paradigm of a just war, which takes its cue from the UN Charter, where you don't need the UN Security Council's authorization to defend yourself. Well, the Christian version of just war thinking does not regard self-defense as the paradigm. It regards the rescue of the innocent, the rescue of the innocent neighbor from grave injustice, which rescue may take defensive or aggressive forms. So it doesn't matter which version of just war theory you buy into, but there's a point where a Christian view does make a difference. Therefore, I won't go into great detail about this, we can talk about it later. Therefore, in my view, in the Christian conception, a just war is a form of punishment. It's even a form of retribution. We can talk about this later, but I'll just tell you, this is very unpopular, this notion. It's very controversial and unpopular. What I mean by that is this. When an injustice is done, something good is damaged. If it's in a relationship, then someone betrays you and lets you down. What's damaged is trust. Friendship is damaged. Right? Something good is damaged. Therefore, a hostile response to the wrongdoing is appropriate. If you care for what's damaged, to respond in some hostile manner to what has been done is quite appropriate. No. Wrong. Not to respond is not to care for what's been damaged. So when there's a grave injustice, war, as a last resort, is a means of making this hostile response, saying, no, stop. It's a hostile response. It is designed, it uses force to stop the wrongdoer. And in that sense, in that limited sense, it is punitive, it is a form of punishment. And it is more specifically a form of retribution. It is a kind of payback. You do this, you deserve that. Now, we can talk, if you want, later on about how on earth a form of punishment or retribution could possibly be Christian. But I won't say more about that right now. Now I'm going to, now I've reached the first point on your handout there. Those who want to justify war in Christian terms are bound to square the justification of war with the New Testament. Yeah? And in particular, they're bound to square it with the notion, or rather with the commandment of Jesus, to love your neighbor, and even more than that, to love your enemy. So, unpromising though it may sound, in Christian view, just war is understood as an extreme form, an odd form, of love for the neighbour and love for the enemy. Particularly love for the neighbour, but also love for the enemy. How on earth? How on earth can it be that? Well, in negotiating his way from the New Testament to just war thinking, Augustine made a crucial move. In interpreting St. Paul's injunction not to return evil for evil, he shifted the primary focus from the damage caused to the motive, from the harmful consequences to the agent's heart. And on your handout there, I think you've got, no, I don't give you the quote, I just give you the reference. But in that letter to Flavius Marcellinus, Marcellinus was a Christian, he was also a tribune, and therefore he was responsible for law and order. And he had been in correspondence with Augustine, in which he'd expressed some unease about being a Christian and yet having to use force to maintain law and order. And what Augustine responded to him was this. He says, "For what is it not to return evil for evil?" And he cites Romans 12:17 and 1 Thessalonians 5:15. What is it not to return evil for evil except to shrink from a passion for revenge? Right? So he's interpreting it as avoiding revenge. He's distinguishing a use of force from the evil motive. You can use force provided you're not motivated by vengeance. Then he says, "For people are often to be helped against their will by being punished with a sort of kind harshness." So the way we put it these days is probably tough love. In the case of war, very tough love. All right, so that's the basic move that Augustine makes. Sometimes one has to do damaging things. One ought to do damaging things, and one may do so provided that love is the motive. So, to take a mundane example, if I'm an examiner of your PhD, and I decide it deserves to fail, and I know that you are going to be deeply upset that you've spent tens of thousands of pounds on this, that it might actually reduce your family to destitution. I don't wish you any ill, and I'm sorry for the consequences, and I know what I'm doing, but I have to tell you, you failed. Okay? Sometimes it's right to do something that causes damage, provided my motive isn't malicious. Okay. If any of you do PhDs, I'm not trying to scare you. But I'm sure it will happen to you. It doesn't happen to many. Okay, but in the case of war, so the claim is that a Christian use of force should be motivated by love. And so my next question, point two, is this psychologically plausible? I mean, is it really plausible that soldiers in combat could be motivated by love? Well, first of all, I'm going to take the easy question, or the easy issues. It's perfectly plausible, I think, that soldiers or people involved in combat are motivated first and foremost by love of their comrades. We push come to shove, love of nation, love of country, even love of family, unless your family is close by, are not what motivate combat soldiers to charge machine guns or take risks. It's love of their comrades. So I think it isn't difficult to find evidence of that kind of love. And let's remember, in addition to enjoining Christians to love their enemies, Jesus also did say, greater love hath no man than he lay down his life for his friends. So if Christians are commanded to love their enemies, it doesn't mean they aren't commanded to love their friends too. So it's not implausible, I think, to say that soldiers are motivated to love their comrades. I put this to Hugh Beach, who's a Christian, now in his 90s. He achieved the rank of general in the British Army. He was himself wounded he served in the army just after Normandy. He was wounded. So he's had some experience of combat there, and I think in Southeast Asia subsequently. Now, he said, or he's written, I never came across the word love as applied to my comrades in arms. I think it would have been met with a snigger, let alone applied to the enemy. So the notion of talking about soldiers loving their comrades, he found not plausible. But I think that's got something to do with his age. His generation wouldn't have talked in those ways. Whereas, I watched a three-part documentary on Sandhurst, which is the British military academy where they train officers. And at the end of this three-part program, the commandant of the academy was addressing the cadets before they went on parade and were commissioned. And the last thing he said to them was this: I'm often asked, is there one golden rule for leadership? As officers, you are serving your soldiers. Someday, you may have to lead men into battle. This is an extraordinary thing to do. You are their servants, and you do that through leading them. That's serve to lead. If you don't understand that, you ain't got it. That's how it works. Go out and love your soldiers. So he wasn't afraid to use the word love. And then here's a witness from Lieutenant Patrick Berry, who served in the Royal Irish Regiment in Helmand Province in 2008. In his excellent book, Call Sign Hades, which I think is one of the best books ever to come out of Iraq and Afghanistan, he describes this incident. He's just shouted at one of his soldiers. And he says, Corporal McCord, I'm sorry for shouting at you in front of the... McCord interrupts me and speaks hurriedly, passionately. I love you, boss. I do anything for you. I take a bullet for you. He looks at me. It's not often that a man tells another he loves him, especially in front of other men. I think of the effort I've made to respect and protect the boys, to build this team, to earn their trust and respect. And we call it respect, because it's easy to say. It's not soft, and it's not embarrassing, but Matt McCord has called it by its true name, love. Simple, platonic love. The love that motivates men to do the most touching, brave, selfless things for their brothers. A love so deep it burns and tingles in you when it flickers, reminding you there are things greater than you, more important than you, things that last longer than you. And sometimes, out here, you get a glimpse and you understand. You understand why soldiers charge machine guns or hold out to the death while others escape. Love. For love melts fear like butter on a furnace. It transcends it. Okay, that's the easy bit from my point of view. That's not difficult to understand. Much more difficult, how on earth can a combat soldier be held to love his enemy? Okay. First thing I want to say is this. We've got to think about what love means, and let me take it down to, as it were, bargain basement level. Okay. Love simply as the absence of hatred. And then I'll raise it a bit. Love as a measure of fellow feeling or sympathy or compassion. That's what I'll get, I hope. And I'm going to call three witnesses. We might think that soldiers commonly hate their enemy. And they sometimes do. I'll talk about that in a moment. But usually they don't. Here, for example, is Richard Tawney writing. Richard Tawney was a graduate of Balliol College in the early 1900s. He lived to become a leading Anglican economic historian. He was a close friend of William Beveridge, who established the welfare state in this country in 1945. He was an Anglican Christian socialist. But in 1916, he was a sergeant in the Manchester Regiment. Although he was well-educated, he preferred to join the ranks rather than become an officer, so he was a sergeant. And on the 1st of July 1916, he was with his regiment on the Somme. And he, with his comrades, climbed up out of the trenches and started marching toward the Germans. Some way between his trenches and the German trenches, he was shot in the stomach. And he lay there for 36 hours until, fortunately, a medic noticed him and took him back to the British lines. And then he was brought to Oxford to convalesce somewhere down across Clements, I think. And while he was convalescing, he wrote an article and he published it in October. And part of the article is expressing his horror at the extent to which civilians indulge in a hatred of the enemy that combat soldiers don't. So he writes, and the word Tommy here is what the British call GIs, ordinary soldiers, Tommy Atkins. So he writes, and this Tommy is a creature at once ridiculous and disgusting. This Tommy, as you see him, you civilians, is at once ridiculous and disgusting. He's represented as finding sport in killing other men, as hunting Germans out of dugouts, as a terrier hunting rats, as overwhelming with kindness the captors of his bow and spear. The last detail is true to life, but the emphasis which you lay upon it is both unintelligent and insulting. Do you expect us to hurt them or starve them? Don't you see that we regard these men who have sat opposite us in mud, square-headed bastards as we call them, that they are the victims of the same catastrophe as ourselves, as our comrades in misery, much more truly than you are? Do you think that we are like some of you in accumulating on the head of every wretched antagonist the indignation felt for the wickedness of a government, of a social system, or if you will, of a nation? Hatred of the enemy is not common, I think, among those who have encountered him. It is incompatible with the proper discharge of our duty, for to kill in hatred is murder, and soldiers, whatever their nationality, aren't murderers, but executioners. Okay, there's one witness. Here's another. Fast forward 20 years. George Orwell, from you may have heard. 1984, Animal Farm. He fought with a Marxist unit on the Republican side in the Spanish Civil War for 6 months. In 1936, the winter of 36-37, and he was eventually shot, he was himself shot in the throat, and survived and got back to England. And then he wrote in his famous book, Homage to Catalonia, published in 1938, he reflected on his experience. And he said, "One of the most horrible features of war is that all the screaming and lies and hatred comes invariably from people who are not fighting." And then he comments on the sniper who shot him. "I could not feel any resentment against him. I reflected that as he was a fascist, I would have killed him if I could, but that if he had been taken prisoner and brought before me at this moment, I would merely have congratulated him on his good shooting." Now notice, just notes there, hatred isn't often found, he says, amongst those who encounter the enemy, first. But secondly, in talking about the sniper, there's a sense of fellow feeling here. Good shooting. We're in the same business here. And even if you shoot me, that's part of the game. So there's a measure of fellow feeling or sympathy here. Now let me up it slightly. Just to stick with the fellow feeling. Chris Keeble, who's a visiting fellow at Harris Manchester College, in 1982 was an officer in the British Parachute Regiment, and he landed on the Falkland Islands and was engaged in a battle with the Argentines at a place called Goose Green. His senior, the commanding officer, was shot dead, and Chris took charge. When I was thinking about these things early on, I gave Chris I asked Chris if it was at all plausible to talk of soldiers regarding their enemy with compassion. Not just fellow feeling, but slightly fuller, richer feeling of compassion. And he thought for a moment, and he said, "Well, yes, it is." He said, "During battle, my soldiers were, as they usually are, tough and fierce. And the parachute regiment is known for being particularly hard. But after the battle," he said, "he observed his own soldiers cradling wounded Argentines in their arms." Okay. So, love as not hatred, love as fellow feeling, love as compassion. It's not entirely implausible, I think, to describe combat soldiers as capable of a certain love for the enemy. But then, this is the third bullet point, is it not true that in order to be able emotionally to kill the enemy, you have to dehumanize them? And surely you can't love someone you dehumanize. Martin Cook wrote an article which I read in January making this point, and quoting a very fine reflection on warfare by an American philosopher who fought in World War II called John J. Glenn Gray. And Gray at one point writes, "Most soldiers are able to kill more easily in warfare if they possess an image of the enemy sufficiently evil to inspire hatred and repugnance." So if that's true, most soldiers find it easy to kill someone they hate, then that presents me with a difficulty. But my question is whether this is generally true and whether it's necessary. I don't doubt it's sometimes true that soldiers hate their enemy. The question is it necessary? Can it be resisted? Well, first of all, you know, you've heard the evidence I've given that soldiers don't always hate the enemy, and yet they seem to be able to fight them. But secondly, I want to just put this thought in your mind. I think that there's a certain sense in which dehumanization is not objectionable, and dehumanization is not the same as demonization. Let me just tell you what I have in mind when I say what you might find alarming, the notion that dehumanization might not be objectionable. Imagine a surgeon applying the knife to the flesh of a living human being. If the surgeon identifies emotionally with the living human being, she won't be able to do it. She has to detach herself. Now imagine worse. Imagine a surgeon in the age before anesthetics. Yeah. You can't do the job unless you harden yourself in a certain way, distance yourself. Take that analogy and then start to apply it to warfare. If you're not a Brit, you probably never heard of Douglas Haig. Hands up, anyone knows of Douglas Haig? Okay, two now, okay. Douglas Haig was the leading field general of the British during World War I, after the initial stages. And he was the one who presided over the Battle of the Somme when, on the first day, 60,000 casualties were incurred, 20,000 deaths. So think about Iraq. America lost 6,500 over what, 7 years? Well, in the Somme, the British lost 20,000 in one day. And the battle lasted 4 months. Okay, so Haig is often maligned for being brutal and callous. Well, here's Winston Churchill talking about, or writing about, Haig. And remember the image of the surgeon. Churchill says, "Haig presents to me in those red years the same mental picture as a great surgeon before the days of anesthetics. Intent upon the operation, entirely removed in his professional capacity from the agony of the patient, he would operate without excitement. And if the patient died, he would not reproach himself." But then Churchill adds, "It must be understood that I speak only of his professional actions. Once out of the theatre, his heart was as warm as any man's." So I see a very clear, not only because of Churchill's analogy there, the general and the surgeon, I think in terms of, I think there's a clear analogy between what the surgeon does and what the commanding officer does. Here's another example. October 1942, during the Battle of El Alamein in North Africa, where troops under General Montgomery are fighting troops under General Rommel, General Freyberg meets with General Curry to give him Montgomery's orders. And according to one account, when Curry's time came to make comment, he rather diffidently suggested that by the end of the day, his brigade might well have suffered 50% casualties, half his men dead or wounded. To this, Freyberg had replied with studied nonchalance, "Perhaps more than that, the army commander, Montgomery, says he's prepared to accept 100%. Okay. To be a commanding general, you have to be willing to spend your men. The if you're going to succeed, it doesn't mean that Montgomery didn't care for his men, but you have to, if you decide you're going to fight war, you have to be willing to do that. In the same way that the surgeon has to be willing to apply a knife to living flesh. What's interesting is that Montgomery was loved by his men because they knew that although he would spend them, he wouldn't waste them. Okay. My sense is that, at least for professional soldiers, when it comes to combat with the enemy, there's a certain detachment, but it's a kind of clinical professional detachment. You have a job to do, and if your enemy presents himself, you'll shoot him until the job is done. It's not that you bear the enemy any ill will, but you adopt a certain position of clinical detachment. And I'm not persuaded that's wrong, actually. That's not the same as demonizing the enemy and regarding the enemy as subhuman or evil incarnate. Soldiers don't have to do that to do their job. And here's a witness from a soldier who fought in Vietnam, Carl Melantes. He says, contrary to the popular conception, when one is in the fury of battle, I don't think one is very often in an irrational frenzy. I was usually in a white heat of total rationality, completely devoid of passion, to get the job done with minimal casualties to my side and stay alive doing it. The first time that this notion of a certain professional clinical detachment in a violent situation occurred to me was when I was chaplain of Oriel in the 1990s. And there was a fellow who was a boxer who used to come to chapel on the evening before he used to box. Since Alex was not a Christian, in fact he was a Hindu, so at least he brought up as a Hindu, I eventually asked him, "Nice to see you, Alex. Why do you come?" And he said, "Well, I need to, as it were, collect myself before a boxing match." I said, "Isn't it odd? I mean, surely, being a boxer means you get immersed in violent and frenzied emotion." And he said, "No. If you want to succeed as a boxer, you've got to stay completely cool. Because if you allow emotion to take you over, you'll make wrong moves and you'll lose. And it's the same with soldiers. There's a professional detachment, which doesn't amount to regarding the enemy as subhuman." Now, time's running out, so I'm just going to go as far as the fourth bullet point, and then I'll have spoken for 45 minutes. Notwithstanding all I've said, it's certainly true that soldiers are sometimes moved to hate the enemy. Often, what moves them is rage at an enemy who doesn't play by the rules. So an enemy who cheats. So an enemy who surrenders, and then when you're moving forward to accept the surrender, picks up his rifle and shoots you. Okay? Or an enemy who mutilates your wounded, or is unnecessarily cruel. Okay? So here's an example from World War II, and I quote, "During the assault on Longstop Hill in Tunisia in April 1943, a captured German drew a concealed pistol and shot several of his Argyll and Sutherland Highlander captors." The Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders are Scottish soldiers. "The Highlanders were roused to a state of berserk fury. We just had a hate at the Germans, the hill, everything. For a few days, they accepted no surrenders. But by the time they'd stormed the hill, losing a third of their own men in the action, they had taken 300 prisoners." So for a period, their rage at this outrageous breaking of the rules made them merciless. But it passed, and within a few days they took prisoners again. Now, I'm not quite sure what the rules of war are currently with regard to taking prisoners. I fear that under current law they'd be war criminals, not taking prisoners. I have to say, I regard their reaction as quite understandable. But even if you don't think that's understandable or condonable, I think you can understand their reaction. And as I'll explain in a moment, I think it can be controlled. I think it's not an inappropriate reaction to react with rage to that kind of betrayal. Just on that, I should say that I don't regard anger as sinful, and in my defence, I appeal to the thought of Joseph Butler, the 18th century Anglican moral philosopher, who distinguished between different kinds of resentment, and he appealed to St. Paul, who wrote in Ephesians 4:26, "Be angry, but don't sin," which implies there is such a thing as non-sinful anger. And of course, once you realize that, if you think back to the Gospels, Jesus' reaction to the Pharisees was sometimes extremely angry. So I don't think anger as such is wrong. Sometimes it may be very appropriate. The question is how to control it. This is my last point, really. So professional regular soldiers get very upset when other people break the rules, and this becomes particularly difficult when they're fighting people who recognize no rules at all. So it's particularly difficult when you've got professional trained Western troops in Iraq fighting insurgents or in Afghanistan fighting the Taliban. Now, it may be true that the Taliban have their own code of honor, but it looks nothing like ours. And according to one person who knows them well, he says that they are widely regarded as being completely unscrupulous. And this is one reason, I think, why a lot of our troops have come back from Afghanistan and Iraq with perhaps larger numbers with psychological problems, because of the enormous psychological difficulty of containing your sense of rage at the way in which these people behave. I'm going to read you another quotation from Patrick Berry's account of his experiences. If you'll excuse me, he swears at a certain point, and I will be true to him, and I will read what's there, because I think you need to understand the depth of anger. But I think you'll understand. But notice, as I read it, the way he reports it, in spite of the force of his anger, the voice of conscience is alive. Okay. So what's happened is that a Talib has tried to lay down an IED, an improvised explosive device in the road, in order to blow up the British troops. And he's blown himself up. Quote, "I was glad he was dead. It was funny. He had tried to blow us up, and the stupid fucker had blown himself up. That was gratifying, warming, pleasant. But later, I see photos of his body, and I feel sick. Somewhere within me, under the hardening crust, compassion still pervades my thoughts. What about his mother, his family? What a waste of a life. My compassion lasts less than 24 hours. As we debate whether to return his body to a mosque before sundown, like the soft, moral Geneva-bound men we are, the Taliban prepare to ambush us at the mosque. Luckily, we don't have the manpower. The family can collect him later. Then we find out about the ambush. Rage. Fuck them, the dirty, despicable bastards. Is nothing sacred? Ambush your enemy as he returns, you're dead? Honor? You bastards. You fucking bastards. I will kill every last one of you. I'm struggling with this war, struggling with our enemy. An enemy that says it is strictly Islamic, yet runs harems and makes and takes drugs. An enemy that uses handicapped kids as mules for suicide bombs, that executes children for going to school. I start to hate them. Hate them for what they're doing to me. Hate them and their terrifying suicide bombs that separate us from the locals. Hate them for eroding me. Do they hate us in the same way? Yes. And I hate the locals for not standing up to them, for harboring them, sheltering them, for not returning our smiles, for not being human, for hating us, for watching us walk over IEDs. Not all of them. Not all of them. Okay, so you hear the rage, and then you hear the voice of conscience. There's a discipline there. It's dangerous, the rage. Not inappropriate, in my view. But conscience is alive. When he came back from his time in Afghanistan, Barry wrote an essay which he was reflecting on his experience. And it's worth, I'll just read two paragraphs of this, where he argues that in effect with proper leadership and with proper training, it is possible for these powerful emotions of rage and hatred to be contained. So here he is. Killing, whatever its form, can be morally corrosive. Mid-intensity counterinsurgency with its myriad of complex situations, an enemy who won't play fair, and the constant enduring feeling of being under threat, compound such corrosiveness. A good tactical leader must recognize this and constantly maintain the morality of those he commands. Sometimes I felt my own morality begin to slip, that hardness creeping in. Sometimes I thought I was soft, but my platoon sergeant was right, and I should shut up and get on with it. Sometimes I'm sure the platoon felt like it too. I was unsure. And at these times my memory would flip back to Sandhurst, to the basics, and I would find renewed vigour that what I was saying was indeed right. My moral compass, for all its wavering, was still pointing north. And that was the most important lesson I was taught in Sandhurst, and that I learned again in Afghanistan. So, there's no doubt that soldiers do sometimes become enraged and can run amok and go berserk and commit atrocities. It's not necessary that should happen. And with well-trained leaders and effective leaders, it can be stopped. Said enough, so it's time for you to come back.
Questions?
You probably sit down, I'd probably.
Fine.
Maybe you probably stand up.
Yeah, maybe actually, yeah, I think that's good for it.
Yeah.
Why are you interested in war, as opposed to a different moral topic?
Oh, okay. First of all, I should say I did peace beforehand. So I've written on the business of forgiveness and reconciliation after civil conflict. So just to make clear that war is not all I've thought about. So that's the kind of context. There are autobiographical reasons, but in some ways those are the less interesting because they're just a matter of fate, given who I am and where I was born, at the time I was born. And besides, not everyone born where I was at the time I was shares my interests, so to some extent it's a mystery. But one of the reasons is that as someone who's chosen an academic career, I'm by temperament an observer an analyst, and I'm cautious. And I admire, actually, people who act and take risks. So this is partly, as it were, me admiring the road not taken. But also, and this is autobiographical, this is to the point, my father fought in the Second World War. I was brought up among people who fought and suffered it. And so I've gone throughout my life thinking, what would I have done if I had happened to be born a generation earlier? And then as a Christian thinking, how would my faith have coped with extreme situations like that, where, you know, you're forced to make very hard choices? So, yeah, it's partly the, though, of course, I mean, a hard choice is also, you know, pacifists make hard choices too. So it's not just the people who fight wars make hard choices. But I'm not a pacifist. So I'm interested in how, and I guess I've met Christians who have worn uniform. Almost without exception, I found them very admirable people. So there's a set of answers to your question. Julie, you come back at me if you want. Yeah.
I have a question. You said for you, you said that the soldiers were not murderers, but merely executioners.
Executioner, yeah.
Yes, I was wondering for example, for the German, the Nazi, the German soldier during the Second World War. I think. Do you think that they were only executioner when they were acting for against the Jewish and everything? Because
No. I mean, Tawney, I guess, was talking about quite how to regard someone who's fighting in a just cause, whether they're an executioner or not. I'm not sure about that. But no, someone who's fighting in an unjust cause, even if they don't commit atrocities, they're killing wrongly. And even those fighting a just cause who do commit atrocities, they also kill wrongly. So soldiers can do murder. I guess the point there was that to be a soldier and to be in combat doesn't necessarily mean that you do murder. It depends partly on circumstance. But you know, if you're killing the innocent, then if you're deliberately killing the innocent, intentionally killing the innocent, then you're doing murder. So no, the Nazis, those Nazis who were responsible for the death camps.
Well, yes, the other Nazis, for example, who were not especially for the death camp, but for example, who invade France or Poland, what do you think about them? Do you think that they are murderer rather than normal soldier, like equivalent to British soldier, for example?
That's a good question. I'm not as clear, now you ask the question, I'm not quite as clear on this as I'd like to be. At the large level, insofar as Germany's invasion of Poland and France was without justification, moral justification, all killing done by German soldiers in those invasions was wrong. So it was wrong. And in that sense, if it was wrongful killing, it was murder.
Okay.
Yeah. But there's another sense in which even soldiers fighting in an unjust cause are bound by the laws of war, and provided they obey the laws of war, they don't commit war crimes. This really complicates matters. But if they slaughter innocent civilians, or if they slaughter the disarmed prisoners, they're then guilty of war crimes. That complicates matters. But the basic answer to your question is no. The if you fight in an unjust cause, you kill wrongfully.
Okay. So as a Christian, for example, all the German Christians, soldiers should say no and don't go to war. when this is unjust cause, or they think it is unjust cause?
Well, they should, if they have strong reason to suppose it is. I mean, yeah. It's complicated insofar as one's got to gauge how far could they have known. You know, we now know that, you know, when the Nazis claimed that the Germans invaded Poland because the Poles had attacked across the border and attacked a village in Germany, Gliwice, we now know that what happened was that German troops dressed up as Poles attacked Gliwice as a pretext for the invasion. But could German soldiers then have known? Possibly not. So there's a sense in which some people can do wrong without being blamed for it, because they couldn't have known. I don't want to say that all German soldiers were willful murderers. That would be too strong. But they may have killed wrongfully, wrongly supposing they were fighting a just cause. It is complicated.
Yeah, their leaders were acknowledging just war theory through their pretense of Poland having attacked Germany.
No, that's very good. Yeah.
And were misleading their soldiers.
As well as
the whole country and the world.
Yes, exactly. So the very fact they felt the need to invent a pretext meant that they, by implication, knew they were doing wrong. It's interesting. Yeah.
And I was actually going to just follow up on that question, if I can, but I was sort of thinking as well, like it seems like a lot of the decisions to go to war, for example, are made by sort of higher-ups in government, for example. And so, I mean, whether or not they're justified is one thing, and the soldiers rarely have much to say about this, I guess, except for those who, you know, eagerly sort of sign on, you know, volunteer, say, in 1939 or something like this. But sort of how does, and you may have answered it already, but how does sort of responsibility fit into that picture, right? Because these soldiers may be, you know, committing murder kind of abstractly, but I mean, surely they aren't responsible for that. Well, I mean, they are, right? So it's complicated, right? Because they're sort of kind of mechanically or physically responsible, but do we hold them morally responsible for that? Because it seems to me that we shouldn't. I guess depending on individual cases, like an Eichmann, for example, would be, but not, you know, Benedict XVI, wasn't he a soldier in the Second World War?
Oh, it could have been.
I think it was. Anyway, that's just kind of an aside, and I always thought that was kind of curious.
No, he wasn't, the man after.
Yeah. So, I mean...
Sorry, who?
The last pope. It was a German soldier during the Second World War. I always thought that was curious, you know. So, I mean, clearly we don't. A lot of people don't have a problem with that, right?
It's important to distinguish between responsibility and culpability.
Okay.
So I can be responsible for something and yet not be blameable for it. So I think I'd say that, you know, all soldiers are responsible for exercising their conscience, and if they have really. If they've really strong reason to suppose this war is wrong, then they should refuse to fight and take the consequences. The truth is that oftentimes, well, it's quite hard for an ordinary soldier to have strong reason to suppose the war to be wrong. Partly because there's no war that's ever fought that wasn't controversial. I mean, most people in this country will say that our war against Hitler was justified. There are still people who say it wasn't. So. You can always find contrary opinions. My view is that the professional soldiers often will have good reason to defer to what government tells them, because they frankly are not in a position to know any better. But there may be occasions when it becomes clear that a war is unjustified, and they are responsible for refusing to fight. But it does mean that, you know, even though a soldier is responsible for for exercising their conscience, it may be they can't know any better, and they do fight in an unjust war, but can't be blamed for it. So they can be blamed for what they do in it.
yeah, that's right. Yeah. I suppose then, I mean, say a soldier doesn't know, and then, you know, is sort of engaged in battle is in the war, and then, you know, comes upon knowledge that tells him this is an unjust war, and his conscience is against it, but he can't pull out. I suppose in that case we wouldn't blame him either.
Well, this is one of the, I mean, There's a German TV series, which in German, Mein Mutter, Mein Vater, in German, our mothers and fathers. In English, it's called Generation War. And that part of the tale, that you've seen it, part of the tale there is of a young German who is very reluctantly drafted and doesn't want to fight this war, but eventually gets drawn in to committing atrocities. Now, I one still has to say committing atrocities is wrong and it's culpable, although one can understand how in that situation he was too weak to resist. But people did resist and took the punishment.
Are we obligated to resist and take the punishment, even if that is going to be execution? Should they have deserted? Because it was the older brother who was actually quite interesting, because he entered and was fully behind it and kind of ideologically at one with the German military. It was the younger brother who was reluctant, who then sort of kind of destroyed his soul in the process and just kind of went along with it. Then the older brother ended up basically deserting by the end.
Yes.
And was going to be executed, but then they employed him in these kind of terrible, jobs. But do you think a Christian who, say the older brother is a Christian, perhaps he was, and realizes halfway through that this is terrible, this is wrong, his conscience is against it, would he then be obligated to withdraw and face death from his unjust military, I guess, in order to do the right thing? Would that be the right thing? Or would he be morally pardonable if he continued to engage it, say, didn't commit atrocities, but was engaged knowingly engaged in unjust war?
Well, I'm inclined to say he would be culpable. Mm-hmm.
In a diminished sense, maybe, or deserve diminished blame, maybe.
Yeah, it probably depends on just how. Yeah, I think if I remember right, in this film, what he's made to do is to shoot civilians. Is that right?
At some point, yeah.
And part of the complexity there is the claim that these civilians are actually partisans, so they're. But of course, they also include old men and women. It seems to me, if my superior officer tells me to shoot these old men and women because they are partisans, the chances of old men and women or young children being involved in armed activity is highly unlikely, and I should say no. Although, this is one of the problems with wars that are fought in part by people not in uniform, is that they blur the distinction between civilians and non-civilians. And to some extent, they bear the responsibility for how professional soldiers react, because in a sense, they're breaking the rules. I want to say it depends on the circumstances.
Phrases.
Yeah,
it seems like you rely pretty heavily on narrative and testimonial, and which is really, it kind of brings it to life. I'm wondering, at which point did you arrive? Did you start with your thesis and then go kind of search for answers in these stories of war, or was it kind of the stories of war that illuminated some of these ideas about hate and about conscience and about love? I'm just kind of curious about the order, and then also, is this a distinctly Christian view, would you say, or can it apply beyond, because you kind of started out with Augustine to Jesus and kind of arrived at this place of love, can it apply beyond the Christian worldview?
Okay. I should say that most of what you've heard this evening comes from chapter 2 of my book. There are other chapters that are not like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the point of this was really to simply to ask the question, if Christians are bound to regard the use of force as an expression of love, I mean, you can say it in theory, but in practice, is it plausible or is it just plain silly? Right?
Yeah.
So that's why I drew from empirical experience. I mean, is it empirically plausible? Okay, then the question, this notion that soldiers should love their comrades or love their enemies, you might be asking, does that only apply to Christian soldiers?
Mm.
And my answer is, well, it certainly applies to Christian soldiers, but in fact, you know, insofar as you know, the laws of war now make it a crime to kill an enemy who is wounded and disabled. So last year, a Royal Marine was convicted of murder because he killed a wounded Taliban gratuitously. And it was controversial, but lots of officers thought that was the right conviction. And insofar as soldiers obey the laws of war, not to use force beyond what is absolutely necessary to achieve their objective, that seems to me actually to be a kind of minimal form of love. It's a minimal form of respect. And then, you know, the if it's true that paratroops in the Battle of Goose Green and the Falklands cradled Argentine wounded in their arms, there's no reason to suppose any or many of those paratroops were Christians. Now, it'd be fascinating to know what kind of training, let's say, officers or soldiers in the People's Liberation Army of China get, and whether this would make any sense to them at all. I did raise this in a seminar last week, and it was reported to me that it wasn't terribly helpful, but two British officers had visited China, had observed the PLA, and their response was, it's very different. But just in terms of the kind of behavior and conduct expected, and toward the enemy, be interesting to know. But I did this early on. I mean, when I went to Hong Kong, August 2013, and was reading about Confucian thought, I was really struck by how it's not the same as Western Latin Christian thought, but there are certainly some strong resonances. Although the PLA is not much influenced by Confucian thought at the moment.
I think it's more clarificatory, but you had mentioned, I think it was Second World War, and this German had pulled out a gun, a pistol, and shot a number of guys, and then for a period of time they took no prisoners and they didn't shoot them. And you said that was quite, the terms you use, understandable, and what was the other one? You didn't use justify, but I was wondering if you could clarify what you meant, because would that be justifiable? Because I can certainly understand and condone the emotions, but the effect of the emotions, I guess I wouldn't. Those are my intuitions.
Yeah. No.
I would say that's wrong. Those actions were wrong.
Yeah. You caught me hesitating because I wasn't quite sure, but I think think of it this way. If the enemy pulls a trick, if one enemy pulls a trick like that, what risks are you obliged to take next time?
I see.
So what's happened here is the trust has been broken.
Yeah.
And now I mean, it's a fine line, but whatever the laws of war say, it seems to me possibly demanding too much of soldiers to expect them to trust. Now, it's actually a matter of forgiveness here, really. Should they forgive, even though the enemy has shown no signs of repudiating what this particular member did. Though it's difficult because I mean, one member of the enemy plays this trick.
Yeah.
Not all the enemy would do the same, yeah. Or would they? But you don't know.
You'd think they'd also have. I mean, one way to handle that would be to be much more rigorous in searching them, for example. And even if they had to strip search them or do something that's, say, degrading, or yeah. Someone would say is degrading, that might be justified. But however, taking a life,
yeah.
Or taking lives, and numerous lives, as a result. I mean, I like to sort of say that that's sort of where reason ought to sort of kick in and start working, kind of to sort of finesse our emotions and direct them, even though the emotions themselves are perfectly understandable.
I think maybe you're right. Maybe we'd say that a general policy of taking no prisoners might well be excessive. Much greater caution in accepting surrenders would not be excessive. Good question.
Just kind of a clarification question too. You used the example of the surgeon for the kind of removing self and distancing from the enemy. I just wonder, maybe this is taking the analogy too far, but you know, to me a surgeon is fixing and mending and helping life, whereas the soldier is killing life. And so is that a valid analogy, I guess? Because I see what point you're trying to make, but does it matter in terms of what it's the purpose for which you are removing yourself?
Well, in terms of the morality of what you're doing altogether, yes, it does matter. Although I'd say that someone who's fighting a just war is using violence and causing physical, even lethal harm in order to create a just peace, not just for the hell of it.
So it's leading to a good, is what you're saying?
So it says that the analogy between the surgeon and the soldier is stronger. The surgeon is also causing harm. I mean, he's cutting through live flesh. It's a form of harm, but you know, in the round, of course, it's a healing. But it may involve moments of dissection or amputation.
So on the basis that the killing is leading to a greater good, that works. I mean, not a greater good, but it's like what you were saying.
The reasoning here isn't utilitarian in the sense of lesser, a smaller evil for a greater good.
Okay.
It's more that it is aimed at correcting a grave injustice, and yes, there's an element of saying is it worth it, but the use of force is also disciplined by such things as motive and intention, and yet the issue of proportion, is this damage worth in some sense the good we're trying to secure, that's a very difficult issue, which I could talk about for an hour.
It's more righting the wrong, it's the justice aspect.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
But you're right, the other point I wanted to make was that, as I put it, a certain callousing of oneself, a certain thickening of the skin, so that one does things that you know will cause harm, is required in all sorts of professional life, actually. Whether it's the PhD examiner saying you failed, or whether it's the employer saying you've lost your job, you can't do those things if you are too sensitive. The question of how one, does that make you a monster if you do that? Not necessarily, although you can become a monster. I'm not quite sure how you avoid it.
Kim.
Do you see mass destruction weapons in a similar way? That if you see a better peace, that like putting a bomb somewhere will bring you a good peace, would you view mass destruction weapon?
Can you repeat the question?
So the question is whether about the use of weapons of mass destruction, whether they could ever be justified. Well, here's one way in which the notion of proportionality does make sense, and that is it does not make sense to use a form of violence that will destroy what you're trying to save. No point. Mm. Right. So when the Soviets invaded Hungary in 56 or Czechoslovakia in 68, the Czechs and the Hungarians appealed to NATO for help. And we weren't prepared to go to war with the Soviets. Why? Because we feared it would result in a full nuclear exchange, which could well destroy the whole of Hungary, the whole of Czechoslovakia, and much else besides. And there's no point in fighting in a way that undercuts what you're trying to achieve. Similarly, and well, I can give another example, but that makes sense. So anything that risks a full nuclear exchange risks destroying what you're trying to protect. Whether there might be certain circumstances where the use of a certain limited, whether the use of a weapon of mass destruction of certain limited power could be justified, it's possible, but unlikely. But having said that, I mean, one needs to remember that the Second World War did cost the lives of somewhere between 60 and 80 million people. That was mass destruction, mm-hmm. not just by one weapon. Though.
I'm sure in your research you have studied so many wars throughout history, and I'm wondering which ones you found the most difficulty determining whether a particular side took a justified action. Some are clearly wrong, and some, like say the Second World War, on the Allied side, we would almost unanimously say was justified.
Yeah.
Which do you find the most difficult to give an answer to?
Well, there are two answers to that. One is Iraq, on which I spend 75 pages of my book at the end, concluding that it was justified, which represents a change of mind. But the first thing I published on that, I said it was unjustified. I could yet be persuaded back. I haven't been yet. But the other one, which you will regard as being exotic, I'm currently reading about the Anglo-South African War of 1899-1901, which I think was probably unjustifiably provoked by the British. They didn't launch it. The Afrikaners launched it, but the British provoked it. But I'm not sure. Yeah, we could talk about Iraq forever.
World War One.
Yeah. Okay. I've done that. That's chapter four. The World War One. You can't ask the question: was World War One justified? Because World War One consisted of all sorts of different decisions. Mm. I mean, so start at the bottom. Should the intelligence services of the Serbian state have been supporting Bosnian terrorists to assassinate the Archduke of Austria? Should the Austrians have invaded Serbia when they wouldn't agree to a transparent inquiry? Should the Russians have come to support Serbia? Should the Germans have given a blank check to Austria? Should the Germans have invaded France? Now, so there's plenty of blame to go around there. What I focused on was whether the British should have gone to war against Germany, given the invasion of France, to which I say yes, in spite of the terrible losses. But you've got to disaggregate it. Some people, Christopher Clark has written a very widely reviewed and highly spoken of a book called The Sleepwalkers. He kind of throws his hands up in the air and says, how on earth can we apportion blame? I mean, you know, how can you answer these questions? Should Serbia have done this? Should Austria have done that? Which I respond, well, yeah, I'm an ethicist, I do that kind of thing. Yes, it's complicated. It's very complicated.
I like that response. You have to start somewhere.
Yeah. So I did. I just regard it as a bigger challenge, really.
Yeah.
But otherwise, if you couldn't do that, then basically you give up trying to make any moral assessment of international affairs.
Have you or anyone else with World War I gone behind those questions of whether the alliances should have been made of one country promising to come to the defense of another given an attack?
Yeah. I don't know exactly what the terms of the alliances were. Whether, for example, France was bound by treaty to come to Russia's aid, no matter what Russia did. It would have been foolish for anyone to commit to a treaty of that kind. In the case of the British, we were not bound by treaty to go to France's aid. But the Foreign Secretary persuaded the Cabinet we were bound by moral obligation. But it would have been utterly foolish to commit yourself unconditionally to fight for someone else's cause, no matter what they did to provoke it. That would be crazy. I don't know enough about the terms of the treaties, but yeah.
And do you deal with the Vietnam War in your book?
I don't, simply because there's three wars I deal with: the First World War, Kosovo, and Iraq. Simply because those are ones the Brits were involved in, whereas Vietnam we weren't. And besides, having done the First World War in Iraq, I was exhausted. Because you know, if you get some these things, you know, you need to. Doing South Africa at the moment, I mean, there's no end of books to read about how to make sense of what happened. And one's moral judgment changes according to what you understand the facts to be and how you put them together. So it takes a lot of reading. I happen to like reading stuff, so it's okay. Vietnam is, I haven't done yet. Though in terms of Christian just war theorists, Paul Ramsey, who probably is the preeminent post-World War II Christian ethicist, Methodist.
Princeton.
He, I believe, thinks that the American involvement in Vietnam was justified. I think that's right. He wrote it. There's a collection of essays called by him called Just War, which I think he argues that. I couldn't give you chapter and verse, but I've been told that.
I can keep going.
Well, why don't we get into this over drinks? But I like that. I love how no matter how big or small the group is, it's always really, really rewarding, the discussion that is.
Some of it is a little smaller, actually.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, well, thanks so much, Professor Bigger.